got a wonderful show for you today, so let's get started. I have a very special guest who is connecting with us from Berlin today. Dr. Melanie Joy is a Harvard-educated psychologist, celebrated speaker, and author of the award-winning book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, which has been published in 12 languages. Dr. Joy is the 8th recipient of the Institute of Giantology's AHIMSA Award, which was previously awarded to Nelson Mandela and the Dalai Lama. Her work has been featured by numerous national and international media outlets, including the BBC, ABC Australia, NPR, and the New York Times. Dr. Joy has given her acclaimed carnism presentation on 6 continents, and the video of her recent TEDx talk on carnism is in the top 1% of the most viewed TEDx talks of all times. She's the founder and president of the charitable organization Beyond Carnism and the author of the books Beyond Beliefs, A Guide to Improving Relationships and Communication for Vegans, Vegetarians, and Meat Eaters, and Strategic Action for Animals. Dr. Joy is also the founding president of the charitable organization Beyond Carnism, a co-founder of ProVeg International, and the co-director of the Center for Effective Vegan Advocacy. Wow, I'm just getting chills knowing that I'm talking to you right now. You have done such tremendous work for our planet. Thank you. Thank you. Can I thank you again?
Thank you. And this is, you know, as you know, a collective effort. There are so many people who are doing this amazing work who enable us to do what we do, part of our team and beyond, and people like you who are just raising awareness, you know, about these critical issues. So it's interesting times we live in, and important work we're all doing for sure.
No, please. Interesting times. Let's not even talk about, today is the State of the Union address in our country. Our president doesn't even know how to spell. Okay, so first, before we get into this wonderful book that we're going to be talking about, Beyond Beliefs, let's just give the audience a review of carnism, which I know you're going down in history for coining this term. It's really enabled so much of our understanding and how we can move further.
Thank you. Yeah, I mentioned carnism and Beyond Beliefs, but I first published about carnism more fully anyway in my book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. And carnism is essentially the visible belief system or ideology. I'll say one more quick thing about carnism, and again, the invisible belief system that conditions people to eat certain animals, and it's the opposite of veganism. Carnism is a dominant belief system. That means that it's invisible and it's woven through the very structure of society to shape norms, laws, beliefs, behaviors, etc. And it also becomes internalized. So it shapes the very way we think and feel about eating animals. And because carnism is a violent system, you know, meat cannot be procured without violence, and egg and dairy production cause extensive harm to animals. Carnism, it runs counter to core human values, such as justice. Passion. So it, like other oppressive systems or violence.
I don't know if it helps the carnists understand what they're doing and what they believe in, but it certainly helps vegans and those who are working against carnism to have analogies and be able to understand the situation a lot better.
Well, I would say, you know, in my experience, non-vegans, and I use the term carnist as an adjective, carnistic food, for example, or carnistic mentality, but not so much to describe people, because most people are, you would say, inadvertent carnists. You know, they're not even aware of carnism. What I have found is that talking about this with people who are not vegan, it's very helpful, because people, you know, most people really do care about animals and don't want them to suffer, and they do deserve and need to know the truth, not just about animal agriculture, but also about eating animals and how this system of carnism has conditioned them to think and feel in ways that are really antithetical to how they would probably think and feel if they hadn't been essentially coerced throughout their lives to look at the world through the lens of carnism.
And many people are, you know, appreciative about learning about this and feel that it enables them to move away from parents.
So it's, in a way, it's a, I don't want to say a way out, but it's a relief to know that something that we've done that we might feel bad about or guilty about, it wasn't our fault.
Well, it's, you know, it's interesting. It's not that we're not accountable, but we can hold ourselves accountable. You know, once we become aware of carnism, we can say, now that I see this system, I have a choice as to how I want to operate within the system. You know, because for better or worse, we're all participants in the system. It's not a question of whether we participate, but how we participate. And with awareness, we can choose to change the way we participate in the system. When people aren't aware, they really can't make their choices or their food choices freely, because without awareness, there's no free choice. So I think it's really important that we recognize that people can eat animals, and that doesn't necessarily make them bad people. You know, they're part of this system. And at the same time, we do want to, you know, encourage people to do less harm with their choices as we raise awareness.
There are some wonderful concepts in this book, Beyond Beliefs, and great examples, and I hope we get to talk about some of them. But my first question is, were you born this way?
Born what, vegan?
No, were you born in this way, or did you learn this during, I know you're Harvard trained, but sometimes I think things are innate, and you're so articulate and you have this great understanding and a great way to articulate situations that are so difficult between people and make it all sound solvable in very loving ways. And I just wondered, did you start this way or is this from a long time of training?
Yeah, well, thank you, Karen. That's really nice of you to say. It's something that, you know, I've always been very interested in relationships and, you know, very interested in looking at how we can bring more compassion into the world and into our lives. And so that necessarily led me to, you know, do a lot of learning and exploration and my own growth and my own development, you know, because it doesn't have to begin with us, but, you know, if we leave ourselves out of the change equation, then we're not really bringing the solution as fully as we could into the world. So I've done a lot of work on myself to try to be more articulate and try to be more of a thoughtful person. And, you know, like everybody else, I was born into this world where we get absolutely no training whatsoever in how to have a healthy relationship and how to communicate effectively. We often learn how to do complicated geometry that we'll never need to use in our lives. And yet we don't learn the basics of how to be like practice human basic decent, you know, basic human decency in the world. And so the good news is that relationship, you know, learning how to have relationships that are healthy and communicate effectively really are things that any of us can learn if we really want to. And it takes practice and it takes work. And it's, you know, I, like everybody, am a work in progress.
Mm-hmm. I've heard, and now you introduce a lot of different concepts for communication and for relationships. I've heard of things like conflict resolution, and I'm assuming that most of the concepts you introduce are things that we can all learn about in programs on communication or relationships. Are some of these your original ideas, or are most of these pretty standard?
Well, I mean, in Beyond Beliefs, it's a synthesis of, you know, I had worked as a relationship coach for a number of years. And so it's Beyond Beliefs is really a synthesis of some of what I believe are the most important pieces or the most important ideas from the literature and healthy relationships and effective communication that are out there. So I really poured through the literature again and tried to you know, find what I felt was most important and distill them down to fit in one book. And it also includes my own thoughts and my own insights about, you know, based on what I understand as a relationship coach, but also as a person who has a lot of experience working with vegans and vegetarians and meat eaters in relationships and also communicating about these issues over, you know, and I've talked with vegans, vegetarians and meat eaters in 40 countries now over a number of years. And I've seen consistently the same issues and the same struggles arise.
You bring this up in the beginning of the book. It's like an introduction. I was nodding my head because, you know, I don't have experience in relationship counseling and all of this stuff. But I've acknowledged that when people talk to me, for example, about problems that they have in society dealing with their veganism, either with their families or their friends and people that they're close with, or their boss or people at work, every social situation, I've always thought this is not just veganism. Veganism is kind of amplifying probably a communication problem or a relationship problem they already have. And you really clarified that in the book, which is really, really helpful.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's with vegans and the book, I wrote the book for people in these inter-ideological relationships, right? Vegans and non-vegans in relationships, and not just romantic relationships, but all kinds of relationships, friendships, for colleagues, family relationships. I also wrote it with the hope that vegan relationships would also be able to benefit from it, because as you point out, much of what I'm writing about are the principles of healthy relationships and the principles of effective communication that apply beyond just vegan, non-vegan relationships. They apply to all relationships. And a lot of the times what people end up struggling with in relationships are not their differences, but rather how they relate to those differences. Now, of course, being in an inter-ideological relationship with a vegan and a non-vegan, you know, this does bring its own, you know, special set of challenges that need to be understood and addressed, you know, in and of themselves. But certainly when people understand the basic principles for healthy relationships and effective communication, they can apply this to any situation.
Okay. I loved a lot of the examples because I've either heard them or experienced them. And this book is so needed because the answers are just right there. And it's just to know that other people have experienced what you're going through is comforting. You don't feel alone, which is really important. And I'd like to touch on some of them. You talked about, for example, the black sheep, and very often people who are vegans in the family have already been the black sheep of the family. And this is another thing that amplifies what's going on. And you explain, can you explain the black sheep?
Yeah, sure.
Concept.
Yeah, in family systems, you know, people in family systems, different family members typically play different roles. And one of those roles is what is referred to as the black sheep. That's often the child in the family. It doesn't have to be, but often it's one of the children in the family who is the scapegoat. It's like the family scapegoat. It's often the child that's a bit different, often, but not always. They're, you know, more sensitive. They stand out from the rest of the family. They don't quite fit in. And so this is also, you know, what I had suggested anyway, the family member is probably more likely to be open to veganism, become vegan. You know, they're different. They see themselves as they're not trying to fit in so much, and they're kind of doing their own thing. And so what happens is that, you know, a lot of times vegans get really stressed out because their family doesn't understand and accept their veganism, and it could become a point of contention in the family. And for vegans who have played the black sheep role, it just becomes one more reason that the vegan will never fit in. Or like, you know, it's like, first you were the, you know, the artist who didn't want to go get an education, you know, and now you're the vegan, you know, it's just like one more thing for the family to have to, you know, point out how you're just not right somehow. And so what I talk about in the book is how important it is to like really recognize that, that like underneath the difference in ideologies, you know, vegan versus non-vegan is a relationship between people. And that's where the focus of attention needs to be if we want to have harmonious interactions or less, you know, interactions with less conflict in them. And to really look at, you know, for many vegans, it's frustrating dealing with their family members. And they'll say like, well, my family is like the hardest to advocate to. They're like the most resistant to veganism. And there are a number of reasons that that could be the case. One of them is quite likely because there are existing power dynamics in the family system. So when you start talking about veganism, it's not just about veganism. It's about, you know, you being perceived as trying to be right yet again, you being perceived as being controlling of other family members, or however that might come across. So it's very important to be aware of the deeper dynamics that are going on between people so that, you know, when you have a healthy process, a healthy way of communicating and relating, you would talk about just about anything without arguing. And when your process is not healthy, you can't talk about anything pretty much without arguing.
And we'll talk about some of those later, the tools that you give to effectively communicate. Another one that you brought up, I'm going to quote you here. It's always very frustrating for vegans when people talk about humane animal products. Mm-hmm. And you write, the concept of humane animal products is actually a public relations strategy created by carnistic industries to maintain their profits. The vast majority of humanely manufactured animals suffer terribly, not only in their dying, but also in their living. And you recognize that people do care and they don't want to be cruel. And yet through language like this and strategies, the cruelty continues.
Okay, so in my book, I talk about how carnism triangulates relationships. What this means is that carnism is like an invisible third party, an invisible intruder into the relationship. So you have a vegan and a non-vegan in a relationship, and then the third party is carnism. And it's there, but it's invisible. People don't see it. And what it does is it acts as a disruptive element, disconnecting the two individuals. And it does this largely because it distorts perceptions. You know, I said earlier that carnism becomes internalized. So it distorts the non-vegans' perceptions so that they perceive veganism in a very different light than it actually is, and are often very resistant to or defended against the vegan message. And so I wrote a chapter in my book really explaining what carnism is for people who are non-vegan and how it impacts relationships to really help people step outside of that system so that they're less influenced by it and it causes fewer problems in their relationship.
I just want to re-quote a quote that you put in the book because I loved it, and it's by Voltaire. If we believe absurdities, we shall commit atrocities. And we see that day after day.
That's right. And what carnism does is it distorts perceptions so that people are not aware of the absurdities or the atrocities that surround us. And many vegans have become aware of that and have stepped outside of the carnist system. So they're looking at the same thing, but seeing the same thing very differently.
I love the film The Matrix, written and directed by the Wachowskis. And you mentioned the film in your book, in chapter 5, I think it was, which was my favorite chapter. And it's an interesting analogy to understand the culture that we live in and how we've been conditioned in a certain way. I remember seeing the film the first time, and the friend that I saw it with was in so much shock that he didn't even like the film. I don't think he wanted to understand it on a conscious level, but did on a subconscious level. It was a fascinating kind of reaction to the understanding, but it's a a great way to understand how we're conditioned. So I appreciate that. So
yeah,
let's talk about the big holiday here in the United States. And I wonder, since you've said you've spoken in 40 countries, I think, what other holidays are similar to this. But the big anxiety moment is Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for many vegans, there's kind of a chronic anxiety that stays with them. And then it just flares up at different times, you know, a family dinner or a first date or, you know, your Christmas party with work with your colleagues.
Now, what's interesting, and you make a really good point of this, is that the problems aren't just with vegans and non-meat eaters. You kind of put vegetarians in the middle, where vegans can have problems with vegetarians and vegetarians can have problems with vegans, but vegetarians can have problems with meat eaters and meat eaters can have problems with vegetarians. The kind of relationship is similar. People with different ideas trying to get along.
Right.
Yeah. So that's a really good issue. But also what I want to talk about just briefly is vegans and other vegans, because we have a lot of tension within our own movement.
Yeah, I mean, there's some infighting in the movement, and there's tensions between vegans and vegans and vegetarians and vegans and vegetarians and meat eaters, like you've said. And part of the reason for this is because vegans and vegetarians and meat eaters are people, and people have conflicts. So, you know, a lot of the problems that we do see, vegans get nervous when they look at the movement and they say infighting and think something's wrong with us. You know, why can't we just get it together? Some of that is that internalized message that we're all a bunch of black sheep that are never going to be normal and never going to be okay. So the problem, a big part of the problem, is that people, you know, have conflicts because people haven't, you know, really learned how to navigate. It's hard enough for people to relate to one another effectively when there isn't stress, you know, but when you throw stress into the mix, it becomes, you know, almost impossible sometimes. And vegans have to contend with a tremendous amount of stress. We live in the midst of a global atrocity, which is carnism. The slaughter and the carnage is all around us. Once you open your eyes to the reality of what's happening to the animals, it's difficult, if not impossible, to not have that impact you emotionally and psychologically. That's normal. That just means, you know, many vegans have a certain level of a post-traumatic response because we do live in the midst of a mass traumatization. And we feel this strong urgency of our mission and what we're trying to stem this tide of destruction. And so with that kind of the stress that many vegans have to endure, and don't get me wrong, I believe that becoming vegan is one of the most empowering choices any of us can make, and it brings with it tremendous benefits and gifts. And it's also true that vegans do have to live with this daily stress of, like, living in a dominant animal eating culture that offends our deepest sensibilities every day. You know, we're looking at the world through very different eyes. We're aware that second by second, countless animals are literally being tortured and slaughtered. And we feel an urgency to try to stem that tide of destruction. And on top of that, we walk around and we see, you know, trucks of animal body parts being driven down the street. We see dead animals' body parts everywhere we turn. Some of the people that we're closest to in the world are putting these dead animals into their mouths and looking at us like something's wrong with us because we find that disturbing and bizarre. You know, vegans spend their lives trying to pick up the pieces of the mess that's left behind by others. And, you know, often our efforts are invisible at best and even ridiculed.
It's the absurdities that Voltaire spoke about that create the atrocities. And it is so absurd and stressful. And I, you know, I talk to a lot of people on this show, and many of the activists have different approaches, and some are absolutionists and feel like we cannot accept anything but complete veganism, and then others are welfarists and want to bring people along in a way that's comfortable for them. And it's really hard to know what is the right way, because there is so much wrong.
Well, I mean, and we don't have like hard data on, you know, we do know, like with the Center for Effective Advocacy, CEVA, that we run, you know, we do know that there is evidence demonstrating that certain types of outreach.
I'm not familiar with CEVA, and I'm definitely going to check them out. And I'm jumping in here because I heard you fade a little bit, so I'm going to give you a moment to come back in clear. And I'm anxious to learn about them. And right. But I wanted to continue. So another great analogy, you bring up a word that I had never heard before. I don't even know if I can pronounce it correctly. Drapetomania.
Yeah, drapetomania. And I, what I was saying was not about SIBO. I was saying that when it comes to this, you know, infighting and among vegans, we don't have the data on whether, you know, certain types of incremental versus more absolutist approaches works better when it comes to certain types of outreach anyway. And what, you know, I would hope for is to help open up this conversation among vegans so that we can talk about it openly without fighting and learn from one another.
Well, I remember John Robbins' book in 1987, Diet for New America. He talked about this, and he's in many of his lectures talked about how we have a lot more effect when we encourage a population to eat less animals than making one or two vegans.
Right. Right. And Tobias Lehner, my colleague, talks about this too. I suggest in my book that vegans consider asking others to be as vegan as possible. So rather than saying, go vegan and be, you know, because often, you know, when you say that, it feels like too much for people. Or saying just reduce, because that can be seen as an end in and of itself. If we ask people to become as vegan as possible, then we, you know, encourage them to think of veganism as the end goal, but allow them to move toward that in a way that's sustainable for them.
Okay, now let's go back to slavery in the United States and how one doctor, and I'm probably many more, were trying to make the black slaves who wanted to become free and flee, make it a scientific illness almost by giving it a name, this desire to want to be free.
I don't remember who came up, you know.
You said it was Samuel Cartwright.
Yeah, okay. I didn't remember the name of whoever coined drapetomania. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, so pathologizing those who challenge the status quo is nothing new. It's been done to activists throughout history. And so we can find that this happens with vegans too. One of the ways that the carnistic culture silences vegans is by pathologizing them, making them seem like something's wrong with them. They have an eating disorder, or, you know, they have, you know, they're overly emotional or whatever.
When the veil is lifted and we realize the society we're living in and that many of us have eaten animals and don't want to anymore and are a bit horrified by it all, and then we have to walk through a society that's sleepwalking in a sense, a line comes to mind from George Bernard Shaw in his play Pygmalion, which also became the musical My Fair Lady, when after Eliza has now learned to speak properly, she says, "What am I fit for?" Feeling so out of place, and you can't go back, and you have to move forward, but it's very difficult.
It's hard to unsee what you've opened your eyes to. And for many vegans, they don't want to unsee because they want to stay awake, even though it's challenging, so that they can be part of the solution.
Now, I don't know if you want to speak about this, but we are in dire need right now of communication skills when it comes to sexual harassment. It's a trending issue, not just in the vegan world, but it is happening in the animal rights movement right now. And everybody's like taken aback because we're supposed to be the models for compassion. And we're finding out that we're people and we're having these issues within our own movement. Mm-hmm. Do you have any advice for us, or we just should pick up more on our communication skills. It's a difficult thing because people are concerned about their jobs. And so on top of caring about animals and wanting to move the issues with animal rights forward, we have our own personal issues and rights.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, this really speaks to why it's so important that vegans have a more inclusive analysis and not assume that.
So you've come up with a lot of different concepts. And again, I'm not sure how much are yours and how much are part of relationship and communication language, but some of them I love because they are compared to actual physical problems like working with the immune system and emotional allergies. I really love that term, emotional allergies.
So the relational immune system was something that I, was it a concept that I developed for the book in order to communicate what I felt was an important, I felt that it was a useful analogy to help.
It's genius, Melanie. It's genius.
Thank you.
Yes. I'm sorry, I jumped in.
Yeah. No, that's fine. Yeah. I mean, I used it because these, you know, some of what I'm talking, there's a lot of concepts in the book and I was, you know, looking for ways to frame these concepts that would make them more easily understandable to people. And so relational immune system was one of them, or integrity as a North Star was another one. So, because it is quite a bit of information for people to take in.
Now you've given some wonderful examples in the book about things that could happen. You also have some great tools for people to work with. And, you know, just like anything, it takes work to change. And you're giving people a process to go through that change, which is great. No pain, no gain. but I'm thinking of some things that I've seen or some things that I've gone through. And I just wonder, how would you recommend responding? So for example, this year I'm celebrating 30 years as being a vegan.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I've just about heard it all over and over
sure
and over
you have.
And over. So I just wonder, for example, you talked about when like a brother sends a sister an email, a recipe or something, and the sister doesn't respond, that sends a message. And so often I get emails from people sending me recipes, vegan recipes. And I just think, you know, we all have our own narratives in the back of our minds. You talk about that too. And I wonder, what's the motivation behind this? These people know I've published recipes. I post recipes on my site all the time. And I want to look at it from a positive point of view, but then another part of me goes, what don't they understand here?
I mean, so what I talk about in my book is simply recognizing the difference between a narrative and a fact. Mm-hmm. And that's the most important, you know, your narrative is your story that you make up about a fact or about an experience that's, you know, tangible. So there isn't necessarily, I mean, some narratives are more accurate than others, but the really important thing is recognizing a narrative for what it is, a narrative, and know that there are many different ways to interpret the same thing. So your people emailing you could be emailing you because they're excited about sharing a recipe with you because they know how much you like recipes to share. They might have other motivations too, but as long as you're aware that your interpretation of their motivation is nothing other than your interpretation of their motivation, because you can't possibly know their motivation unless they tell you, then it helps you to be less reactive.
Emails are especially hard because you don't get a tone of voice. You can't see the person's right. expression. So it's a lot easier to make up your own story.
That's right.
The danger of text and emails.
That's right. That's why we have to be extra careful.
Right. And then there are the times when people are really trying. I know many people have experienced this. You're sitting in a restaurant with non-vegans and you're all looking at the menu and someone is reading the menu for you and saying, oh, you can have this and oh, you can have that. And I don't know what the narrative is there, but I'm thinking, yes, and you can have this too, and we can all eat vegan. But it's an interesting thing when a non-vegan wants to help a vegan order.
Yeah, I mean, and again, there are a lot of different ways to interpret that. So when I go out with my family, the non-vegan part of my family, they frequently do that. But when I go out with my vegan friends, they do that as well. You know, they'll look at the menu and they know me and they'll say, oh, because they know that I like to eat healthy foods. And they'll say, oh, look, there's this great kale salad here. You could have that, Mel.
yeah, I guess everybody does that. We're people, and people come with stuff.
And it's really hard to know people's motivations. Like, it's actually pretty much impossible to know people's motivations. I think if we give people the benefit of the doubt and assume goodwill, we're more likely to be open. We encourage them to be their better selves, essentially.
But you've talked about this, and I don't know the terminology you've used, but when we have a history of mental, verbal abuse or physical abuse, or just a history of dynamics in our family, we become reactionary in certain situations and we assume things even when they're not meant. Oh, triggering. You called it triggering in some spots.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. So, I mean, and that's true. And that's why it's just important to know, like, so much of what happens with vegans and non-vegans communicating is that there's a deeper issue that's the problem that's getting expressed through the vegan, non-vegan difference.
Yeah. So I know for me, I just don't like being told what to do.
Most people don't like being told what to do.
And it goes, I mean, I came out of the womb that way. So it's something I need to work on. Now, you're in Berlin. And
that's right.
Why are you in Berlin? I know Berlin is like a hot spot of veganism and all kinds of wonderful progressive things, but what brings you there?
It is that. I am in Berlin because I fell in love with a German 5 years ago and moved to Berlin to be with him and ended up getting married to him. So, and he's also my colleague. He runs ProVeg International, which is a leading vegan organization here in Europe, international organization. So we do
so
a lot
can
of
I ask, can I assume he's vegan?
He's vegan.
Yeah. So, I mean, you talk about relationships a lot and how we can discuss our beliefs and go through a process rather than the content of what we're talking about and how that's really important in a relationship. But it's a lot easier when a vegan lives with a vegan.
It certainly makes things, you know, it certainly makes a lot of things easier. And, you know, there are people who can live together with non-vegan as long as their process is healthy enough. People will always have differences. You know, you could find that you're in a relationship with another vegan, but that person's highly, highly introverted.
Okay, I think you're coming out again. So let's take a little breath here and bring you back clearly.
Okay.
And so can you give me... this isn't exactly related, but you're in Berlin, and tell me, for people who haven't been to the city, how it might differ from other places in terms of its progressiveness.
I mean, Berlin was voted, I think, last year, the most vegan-friendly city in the world. It's very, very progressive and very vegan-friendly both. And they don't always go together, surprisingly enough. But it's a very alternative city. People come to Berlin because they want to be able to be themselves. It's a very nonconformist city. And it's also very, very politically progressive. And there's a lot of vegan awareness here. So wherever you go, people know the word vegan. And you can get vegan foods pretty much anywhere.
Yes. And it's vegan in Berlin, is
That's
it not?
Right. Close enough.
Yeah, good. All right. Now, I think I read that you have another book coming out, or is it out already? I saw a post where you wanted people to read a manuscript for another book.
Yeah, that's
Well, since we've just announced it, it's a manuscript. Yeah, it's not published yet, but it's in the process of coming out. I don't know when it's going to be out, but I do. It's on the psychology of oppression.
Okay. Well, we could talk about that for a long time because it's a big topic.
It's huge. That's right.
And there's probably many shades of oppression, unfortunately.
Well, it's what I was, you know, referring to earlier, where there's this assumption that, progressive thinking, it grows in a linear process, that like we become sensitive to certain human groups and to other human groups, and then eventually we make our way to animals. And if you become like sensitive to animal issues, or rather aware of your privilege, human privilege, then somehow that's like the final frontier. But it doesn't, progressive change doesn't always work that way, at least not psychologically. And so what I look at in my new book is really the psychology of oppression and the same mentality that underlies, oppression of animals underlies oppression of humans. And I look at that a lot than I had in my earlier books.
Okay. So I'm really glad that you wrote this book. It's a guidebook that we definitely need. I've never seen anything like it, especially not for the vegan movement, and we need it desperately. And I hope people will pick it up and work through the lessons. And also, you mentioned that we're not taught these tools, these skills in school. And I think there are pockets. There are some schools that are teaching children how to relate better to each other. I'm here in the Bay Area right now, and I have some friends who have children in schools in San Francisco, and I'm just blown away with how these children are taught to relate to each other. So we can do it.
Absolutely.
It's going to take some time.
Absolutely. And we can learn it. And that's the beauty of, these kinds of skills. If you're really committed, you can learn it at any age. And and relationships, all kinds of relationships, whether it's family or friends or even just, casual relationships with people that you encounter for 10 minutes at the grocery store. They offer us an incredible training ground on which to practice the very principles and tools that we need in order to be healthier human beings ourselves and more fulfilled and more present and lead more authentic lives.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Melanie Joy, for writing Beyond Beliefs, a guide to improving relationships and communication for vegans, vegetarians, and meat eaters, and strategic action. Oh, and you also wrote Strategic Action for Animals. Oh, no, that's part of the title, Strategic Action for Animals.
No, that's a separate book. That was
my first
book.
I'm reading, it's all in italics and I'm not reading it correctly. So that's a separate book. But anyway, we're talking about, I'm going to repeat it, Beyond Beliefs, a guide to improving relationships and communications for vegans, vegetarians, and meat eaters. It's a lovely, lovely work. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for taking the time to join me today from Berlin, and have a good day. Thanks.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye. Hi, that was Dr. Melanie Joy, the author of Beyond Beliefs, and it's a very, very important book. And you can also visit Beyond Carnism, her nonprofit, which is at carnism.org. Okay, we have a few minutes left, and I wanted to tell you again about this program. It's All About Food, is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, weightlifters, and vegans and vegetarians get lower rates on their life insurance. I've given the link before, but I may have given it incorrectly. It's healthiq.com/IAAF. healthiq.com/IAAF. And as I'm reading it on another page, I see I have to correct the link there because it's not right. But you can see if you qualify. And I'm very excited about this company and giving benefits to people who are really living a healthier lifestyle and can be rewarded as a result. So as I mentioned, I'm here in California, and my partner Gary and I are doing The Music Man. We are directing it with a group in San Jose, and it goes up, oh my goodness, in about a week and a half. And anybody who's been involved with putting up a show know it always gets very intense towards the end, and you wonder how it's all going to come together, but somehow with the magic of theater, it does, and we're all learning a lot in the experience. And because we're here and we're not at home with our pantry and all of our spices and all of our pots and pans and things that we like to use all the time because we love working in our kitchen and making our own food, we have to do so wherever we're staying. And it's always challenging, but kind of fun. And we do eat out a lot more. And I'm always trying to be careful when I eat in restaurants. It's always, like I like to say, a leap of faith when you're in a restaurant, because you're trusting the people that are preparing your meals. And even though here in the United States, we have health codes and government organizations that oversee restaurants and make sure that they're staying sanitary and keeping clean and following specific rules, things can happen that are unexpected. And I had one of those experiences recently. Let me know if you've ever experienced something like this. We've been going to a restaurant, a Mexican restaurant that I've enjoyed a lot over the years. They are not a vegan restaurant, but they do offer vegan food, and they also claim to use locally grown produce whenever possible, which is easier here in the Bay Area than it is in other places. And they say they don't use GMO ingredients, and I like that. And there have been a number of dishes that I have been able to order there. Well, I've been trying to eat cleaner at this restaurant, so I went with a salad that normally has chicken and cheese, but you can order it without it, and then a side of beans and rice. And I got my salad, and I was eating it with my friend and having a nice time. And then there was a texture and a flavor that was in my mouth that I had not experienced in probably 30 years or more. Now, I stopped eating meat about 45 years ago, and I went vegan 30 years ago. So it's been a long time since I've eaten meat, and I know what it tastes like. I know what it smells like because it's always around. But there was a piece of meat in my salad, and I didn't eat it, but I did get to taste it. And if you're not used to it and you feel the way I do about it, it's quite traumatic. And I went back to the counter, and they were very nice about it. And I'm trying to use my communication skills effectively so that I'm not blaming anyone in particular, and just having everyone understand and coming to a solution that works for everyone. And they made me another salad. And then I went back to the table really careful about what I was eating. And sure enough, there was another piece in the new salad. Oh, so when I say it's a leap of faith when we're going out to eat, that's what I mean, because sometimes we're going to get something that we didn't ask for, and sometimes it can be very traumatic. I know a relative of mine, when she was very young, she went to a chain restaurant, and was raised vegetarian, and she was given something that had chicken in it, and it was very, very, very traumatic for her. And then people I'm with, when they don't understand, you know, I'm trying to keep my cool and just get the food that I want. I try and make an analogy of how offensive it is for me, so that maybe people can understand the impact. And I'll say something like, well, imagine if there was a finger in your salad. And then the reaction, of course, is, oh my God, goodness. Anyway, it's difficult, the world that we live in, is it not? And then yesterday, we were at another place that we like very much, that we've been eating at for a long time. It's a little, I like to say, hole in the wall. Just a couple of tables, and we go there occasionally for pho. It's always very difficult for me to say pho. I want to say pho, the Vietnamese noodle soup. But it's a place that serves vegan food. And we go there from time to time when we're here in San Jose. And yesterday, we were having our pho and our vegan Chinese chicken salad. And I started to feel like pressure in my temples. Have you ever had that phenomenon? I used to have it as a child, and I determined at one point that it was because there was MSG, monosodium glutamate, in the food. And more Asian restaurants that I've been to since then have stopped using that as a seasoning because so many people have problems with it. And I had never experienced it in this restaurant, and both Gary and I experienced it yesterday, so I'm kind of concerned about what's happening there. But even if you're eating vegan food, there can be seasonings and artificial ingredients, a whole host of things that could be put on the food. We have to be so careful sometimes, and we do the best we can, don't we? So that's about being creative. And it's inspiring me to do more preparation where we are. But it's nice to eat in a restaurant from time to time. So these are some of the challenges that we have eating outside of the home. Even eating inside of the home, too. Of course, there's more and more issues with foodborne related illnesses that come from the contamination in food. It's a challenge. But the more of us that are aware and make demands and communicate effectively, so I want to communicate these issues with both of these restaurants, but I don't want to do it in a way that will be damaging to their a business, for example. And I will have to do that very soon because their expressions, the squeaky wheel, whatever. We don't want to be demanding in a angry way, but we want to be able to bring attention to those who may not realize either the ingredients they're using or maybe the process in which they're separating the meat and the vegetables is not the best, and they need to rearrange things, or maybe there's somebody new that's working that doesn't really understand the situation. And this is where compassion comes in, and I need to reflect on my own actions too when these things happen, because it's so easy when you're served something that isn't what you expect and what you wanted and what you paid for, and when it goes against everything you believe in, to be reactionary. And I think that's probably the biggest lesson that we have to learn here in life is to not be reactionary, to pause, take a moment, and think of the best course of action to get the best result for everyone. And that's where breathing comes in. So I'm going to end this program with all of us taking a nice big breath. Because when we have some sort of conflict situation, breathing really, really can make a big difference when we take a moment and pause and not be reactionary. That can really help. So thank you so much for listening today. I hope you got a lot out of the program listening to Dr. Melanie Joy. And I definitely encourage you to visit her website, carnism.org, and get this book, Beyond Beliefs, as well as her other book. This concept of carnism, as I mentioned before, is quite profound and will help us all in a dialogue to understanding what we're doing here as humans on Earth, the absurdities, as Voltaire called them, as we're committing atrocities. Thanks for listening to me today on It's All About Food. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you can find me at info@realmeals.org if you want to send me any comments and questions, and visit me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's where I live. Have a delicious week.
Thank you.